Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. Emmy Laybourne's Monument 14 will blow you away. The first novel in the trilogy, it forces you to ask the hardest questions about survival and the human condition, which is exactly what happens with our 14 survivors.
You know, it was my intent with Monument 14 to write a book that was realistic, that really put you in a catastrophe that you could believe, and that also had a great velocity in terms of plot. I just wanted a book that was sort of like, my brother described Monument 14 as like falling down the stairs, you know, like you just bam, 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 bam. I wanted the plot to roll out really fast.
It did. It was such, I don't want to say an easy read, because you were tense most of it, thinking, oh my gosh, what would you do to survive?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, you just couldn't stop turning those pages.
Thank you. I can't think of a better compliment.
So to give our listeners some background, the world is really just crumbling around everybody, and we're set in Monument, Colorado. And the interesting thing is with how you've set up your characters, thanks to a smart-thinking school bus driver, the children have been brought to a greenway, which is really like a giant Walmart or a super Target.
Yes, yes. What happens is, this is just in the very first chapter, due to a chain of environmental catastrophes, a hailstorm of unprecedented severity rains down on Monument, Colorado. And that hail causes these two school buses that are in a row. One of the school buses crashes, and the other one, the bus driver, Mrs. Woolley, decides to drive the bus right into this greenway, which, as you said, is like a Target, to get the kids out of the hail. And then she sees that the other bus has crashed and is lying on its side, so the hail is slamming down through the windows, really slaughtering the kids inside. So she backs up her bus and rescues the high school kids. And then you have 14 kids. You have 6 high schoolers, 2 13-year-olds, and then a bunch of really little kids, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, who are all in this store together. Mrs. Woolley goes off for help, and then the security gates come down, trapping the kids inside, but more importantly, keeping everybody else out.
The dynamic that is going on within this greenway with the teenagers, preteens, and then all these little kids, I think is absolutely brilliant, because it's less of a Lord of the Flies type thing and more of who's going to take the roles on as being the caregivers and begin adding structure to their time of being housed in this place.
Yes. Well, thank you for seeing that. You know, the book is a thrill ride, and it's scary, and it's dark. But underneath it all, I really think it's about taking care of each other and how these kids, you know, have to learn how to organize and take care of these little kids so that they have the best odds for survival. But it's also like, you know, they can really express their humanity at a dark time.
I find it so interesting that as I was reading, I'm thinking to myself, well, number one, you forget that they are just teenagers. And number two, you think, well, if these were adults, the story would be completely different. And I think significantly more violent as well.
I think that could be right. I think that could be right. There's something about them being kids, I think, that makes them know that they all have to band together if they're going to make it. They really have to take care of each other. Whereas if it was 14 adults, well, you'd have people setting up camp in different parts of the store, and they would fight about the resources, and, you know, everyone would be taking care of themselves. But in Monument 14, these kids are bound and determined to take care of each other, which was fun to write. You know, I felt bad. I'm a mom. I have 2 kids, almost 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. And so, I just put my characters through such horrible, horrible things in Monument 14. And I love kids. But all the while, it was comforting to me to know that at the same time as I was putting them through these terrible things, I was also letting them take care of each other.
There's that nice way of innocence in their survival instincts.
Yeah.
Our main character is Dean, and I just, you know, I really liked him, which is good. I mean, you want to like your main character, but the way he is, he's kind of he's kind of invisible to the other kids. Well, in the former life, before everything happened and before he was stuck in these places, he just was kind of the weird guy, as opposed to his younger brother, who was also there, who thankfully is a tech geek. So people know him and they know they can go to him for help.
That's right. You know, I saw Dean as one of those kids. There were a couple of them in my school, in my high school, who hit puberty really late. So for a long time, when everybody else was, you know, sprouting up and becoming manly, Dean was still looked like a little boy. And then all of a sudden, in fact, in the summer right before Monument 14 takes place, he's had his growth spurt and outgrown his clothes four times over. And he's sort of poised at the outskirts of popularity, waiting to make his entree. And if this whole catastrophe hadn't happened, you know, I think if you gave Dean a year, he would be really well liked and he'd have a lot of friends, and he would even have had a chance to talk to Astrid, who's the character in the book that he has this enormous crush on. But when Monument 14 begins, you're right, he's sort of socially invisible to the people at his school. And of course, he becomes very important very quickly when they're stranded in such small numbers.
And then on the flip side, you have Jake and Brayden, who are the jocks and the way popular guys.
Yeah, a lot of Monument 14 is about social dynamics and sort of the innate bravery and coping mechanisms that people have. And I wanted to see, Jake is this really popular, really charismatic, charming guy who can't handle it. He cannot handle this tragedy. It completely unglues him, and he seeks solace in the drugs from the pharmacy. You know, he can't deal with it. Whereas in the beginning, you think he's a natural leader. In fact, he's put in charge of the kids by Mrs. Woolley, the bus driver, before she goes for help. And Brayden is tougher. He's a bully, and I actually have a lot of sympathy for bullies because I know that they've just been bullied in their own right. But he's tough, and he's going to get what he wants. Brayden is sort of a heartthrob, too. He's very handsome, and he causes some trouble with the girls in the store.
And he knows he's a heartthrob, obviously, but it's...
Oh, totally. You know the guy. You dated him. I dated him. We all dated a Brayden at one time or another. Or maybe dated is too strong a word. But anyway, yes, he's a heartthrob, that's for sure.
And it's the way that people like Dean, Jake, and Brayden and the others are finding these qualities within themselves that they didn't know was there, or that they had hidden so far down as to not seem vulnerable. And they are just coming out
You're
in these situations.
That's absolutely right. And because you know and I know that in a crisis, your true nature is revealed. Your all of the nicey-nicey personality elements that you lay on to get along in the world are stripped away, and you go forth, you know, really as who you are.
And I think we see that most in the kids because they don't have that filter. They don't have that internal filter saying, don't say this and don't do that. They just do what they want, what they think they should do, and say what they want. And I think that's completely prevalent in Max.
Yes. Oh, I love that little Max. I've been toying with writing some kind of a companion story. Max is this tow-headed first grader with a preposterous cowlick who is from the wrong side of the track in Monument, and he spends his time hanging out with his parents at strip clubs, and just the stories he tells are just completely degenerate, but he's just eight. He doesn't know. He just tells them like, oh yeah, you know, down in Emerald, the strip club, once I drank these shots and they looked like jello, but oh, it was horrible. he's definitely not holding anything back.
And at first they don't know if he's lying, but then they're thinking he's way too young to even know what this stuff is to lie about it.
Right, right. He's got way too many details. They're really convincing. He describes the strippers dancing as a bunch of moms wearing G-strings. I don't know why that's funny to me.
No, it really is. Just the way he thinks of it, no, and logically, in his mind, that's what it
right,
is.
Right, they're just a bunch of moms because they're not kids. They're grown-up ladies, so they must be moms.
And then on the flip side, you have Baptiste, and he has grown up in a very strict religious background. So everybody is sinning, no matter what they do. They're sinning.
Yes. Yes, sin, sin, sin. I really love Batiste. He changes a lot during the course of the book. And in fact, I just finished working on the sequel, and he changes a lot in the arc of the entire series. He goes from being this really, really small-minded kid, although, you know what, I mean, I don't think kids are small-minded. I think he's just, at the beginning of the book, he's spewing what he hears in his family. And by the end, he's not. He's really, you know, lets go of that kind of judgment of people and joins the group in a wonderful way. It turns out that Batiste can cook, so he becomes, I think he's 9 years old, the nine-year-old chef of the group. He makes delicious food that I wish I could make. He's a much better cook than me.
As we've been talking about this wonderful dynamic between the teenagers and the children, and they're not going outside for a reason. I mean, they're not right. just in here because they're scared to go outside, but there's actually more going on beyond that hailstorm, which was throwing down hail the size of bowling balls. But
yes.
There's a lot more happening out there. And unfortunately, the teenagers have witnessed it firsthand.
Yes, that's right. Without giving away too much, the hailstorm, and there's an earthquake as well, breach chemical warfare component storage at NORAD, which is nearby to Monument, Colorado. And so some stuff gets into the atmosphere. This is set about 12 years in the future. So some really horrible, horrible chemical warfare components are released that attack you based on your blood type. And so the kids have experienced these compounds when they tried going outside. They go up through a hatch in the roof. Then they realize that they can't let these compounds get in, so they seal every nook and cranny. They, you know, fortunately they have a lot of air inside the store that's safe to breathe. But it makes the world outside incredibly violent and dangerous. And in book two, which will be released next summer, which is called Monument 14, Sky on Fire, they come into contact with the compounds in a more direct way. And it's very dark.
Ooh, oh, no.
I know. I'm so sorry. Oh. It was very, honestly, it was very hard to write. But I do believe that a story takes on its own life and it sort of demands to be told in the way it presents itself to you. So I had to tell the story the way it was, but Katie, it's a little darker than might be prepared for.
Oh, no. This novel is an absolute page-turner, and it is Monument 14. Emmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a delight to be here. Thank you so much.
Again, Emmy Laybourne's novel is Monument 14. It is published by Fywell & Friends. And this Sunday, June 17th, you can meet Emmy, as well as several other YA authors, during the Fierce Reads Tour at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York. The event begins at 4 p.m., and guests are required to RSVP by emailing rsvp@oblongbooks.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.